Well, I'd like to thank you for that very kind and warm welcome, and to express again my sense of real privilege at being here. I find it a most encouraging day. I would like to say this, and especially perhaps for those who are not present and who are listening, that while I was in Westminster Chapel for 30 years, it was my privilege during that long period to receive many visitors from your country who would come to see me at the close of a service. I particularly treasure those men who were in the forces, your forces, during the war, the last war, both in the Army and the Navy. I look back with very great joy at the many who then came in to see me. Many testified to having received blessing. And on my various visits to this country, there has been nothing that has so gladdened my heart as to see such men coming on to greet me again, some of them now bringing with them their wives and their children, whom they hadn't got when they were in the war. And I've seen their eyes fill with tears as they were telling their wives that this was the man to whom they used to listen during those dark days of the war. So it's a very great joy indeed to be with you once more. But I'm particularly glad to be here in this church, and for this reason, we're all of us who are truly Christian at this time engaged in a very great and a very grievous battle. We're in it in Great Britain as you are in this country. We are fighting for the faith, fighting for the life of the true church. And sometimes, some of us, particularly in Britain, where perhaps we haven't got as many evangelical people as you were privileged to have in this country, we tend to feel a little bit discouraged. We tend to feel that we're a small company of people. So I cannot tell you what a joy it is to be here today and to see this great church and this great concourse of people. It's gladdened my heart and it's truly encouraged me. So I thank God for this landmark Baptist temple and its famous and zealous and valiant fighter for the faith, the minister, Dr. John Rawlings. Well now, I'm sure that you'll allow me just to leave what I feel in my heart this evening on just that note, in order that I may continue really what I've just been saying by calling your attention to some words that were written by the great Apostle Paul in his epistle to the Romans. And in the first chapter, let me read a few verses beginning at verse 11. He says, "For I long to see you, that I may impart unto you some spiritual gift, to the end that ye may be established, that is, that I may be comforted together with you by the mutual faith both of you and me. Now I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that oftentimes I purposed to come unto you, but was led hitherto, that I might have some fruit among you also, even as among other Gentiles. I am debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. So, as much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are at Rome also. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith." But I want in particular to call your attention now to that 14th verse. I am debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. I call attention to that because it is one of the many definitions that we find scattered about in the various writings of this great apostle of what it means to be a Christian. That's why I'm calling attention to it. And I do so for the reason that I've just been giving. We are living in these days of terrible confusion. I suppose there's nothing that is more characteristic of our world tonight than just this very element of confusion. Doesn't matter what realm you look at, you see nothing but confusion. Even in the realm of politics, there is confusion. The old labels, the old names seem to count for very little. Everything has become mixed up. And it's true in the realm of thinking, what people call philosophy. There was a time, I'm old enough to remember it, when people used to say that the material came up to one level and the spiritual started at another. But now they're talking about the spirit, even in substances like iron. Everything is said to be spirit. There is this confusion. But when we come to the realm of morals and of behavior and of conduct, well, this confusion of which I'm speaking is surely tragically evident and obvious. Today, the problem is not what is moral or immoral. So there are people who don't even recognize morality at all. The whole notion of morality is being questioned and queried. And things that 40 years ago every decent person would agree about as being wrong and reprehensible has almost become the thing to do by today. This terrible confusion. But the most serious confusion of all is the confusion in the so-called Christian church. And it is a confusion not about secondary or third-rate or unimportant matters. The confusion here is with regard to the very meaning of the term Christian. Now, it's not surprising that masses of people are outside the church. When they hear these contradictory voices coming to them over the radio and the television and what they read in the newspapers, all of them claiming to be Christian, and yet diametrically contradicting one another. It's not surprising that the church is as she is. It's not surprising that the world is as it is this evening. And my dear friends, I therefore make no apology at all for calling your attention to this primary, fundamental question. What is a Christian? We can't make any assumptions today. Now, there's all this talk about uniting the churches, ecumenical movement, world church, and so on. But surely before we begin to discuss matters like that, we should be clear about this question. What is a Christian? What does it mean to be a Christian? Well, I needn't weary you, and I haven't got the time, in any case, to give you the various foolish and wrong and false notions that are current with respect to this. There are people calling themselves Christian who belong to the so-called Death of God movement. Don't even believe in God. Have no basis whatsoever. Others think that it's just to be good and to be kind and to be friendly. Others think a Christian is just a man who is against war and against bombs, some kind of pacifist or something of that description. These are the ideas that people have as to what it is that makes a man a Christian. I say, therefore, that it is essential that we should be certain in our minds as to what really makes a man a Christian. Now then, here we have the great authority on the subject, the Apostle Paul, the greatest preacher, greatest evangelist, greatest teacher that the world has ever, the church has ever known. And this is what he says. But now I can imagine someone saying, now wait a minute, I can see what you're going to do. The Apostle Paul in that verse of yours, that 14th verse of the first chapter of Romans, is talking about himself. And if you were going to hold up the standard of the Apostle Paul to us as this critic, well, of course, you'll be able to prove very easily and very simply that there are very few Christians in this congregation or listening on the radio or anywhere in the world tonight. But you won't be fair. The Apostle was such a unique man, such an astonishing man. And you mustn't compare us with him. Now, wait a minute, lest you think that you can get out of this by arguing like that, let me show you that the Apostle himself makes it impossible for you to do so. He says, I long to see you, that I may impart unto you some spiritual gift, to the end that ye may be established. Then, fearing lest somebody might say in Rome, who is this man who puts himself up on a pedestal and says he's got something to give to others? He hastens to add, that is, that I may be comforted together with you by the mutual faith both of you and of me. No, this is not only true of the apostle, it's true of all. Great man though he was, the apostle Paul as a Christian is in exactly the same position as every other Christian. As he says himself, he is simply a sinner saved by the grace of God. I am what I am by the grace of God. He had nothing to boast of. As a Christian, he's in the same position as every other Christian. Very well, what is a Christian? Here's his answer. I am a debtor, both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. What does he mean by this? Let's examine ourselves in the light of this. My dear friend, this is a subject about which no man can afford to be uncertain for a moment. The most important question in the world at this moment, more important than the war in Vietnam even, or anything else, is just this. Am I a Christian? Are you a Christian? Do you know it for certain? Why is this the most important question? Well, for the reason that it not only determines your life in this world, it will determine your eternal, your everlasting destiny. It's the question of questions. Very well, here's his answer. He says, I am a debtor. What does this mean? Well, you see, it means this, doesn't it, in the first instance. He's a man who's got something to give. He owes people something, so he's got something to give. And the apostle has just been saying that as I've read to you, I long to be with you, he says to see you, that I may impart unto you, pass on to you, some spiritual gift. So here is the first thing which is true about the Christian. He's a man who's got something in his possession that he can give to another. Why do I emphasize this? Well, for this reason. There are so many people today who seem to think that the Christian is a man who's looking for something. If you got your idea of the Christian from the religious books and journals, so many of them today, you'd think that a Christian is a man who set out in some great quest and search for truth. He's a man who's looking for what they call reality and for truth. He's an intelligent man who's reading books on philosophy. He's anxious to discover and to find. And there is this idea today that the Christian is that sort of man, that whereas the majority of people are just content to go on eating and drinking and indulging in sex and never think at all about their souls and about eternity, the Christian is a thoughtful and an intelligent man and who's trying to discover the meaning of life. He's looking for some way of escape, some means of salvation, a seeker and a searcher after the truth. But you see, this definition of the apostle condemns that immediately. The apostle isn't saying here that he longs to be in Rome in order that he may join the research team in the great quest for truth and for reality. No, says Paul. I'm longing to be with you, not that we may look for truth together, but to tell you about the truth I've already found. I've got it. I'm not a seeker. I am a possessor. I have something in my possession. Or in the same way, there are many who seem to think that the Christian is a man who is hoping someday for salvation. Oh, they say, I wouldn't like to say that I am saved. They regard that as an impertinence almost. They say, you've no right to say, who are you to say that you are saved? No, they say, the Christian is a humble man, and what he says is that he's hoping that sometime or another before he arrives in eternity, he will know that he's a Christian and that he will have found salvation. He's hoping for it. But again, you see, the apostle makes that definition quite impossible. He doesn't say that he's hoping for salvation, that he wants to go to Rome to sit on a bench with them to hope that something will happen in some mystical manner. No. He's not a man who's hoping for it. He's a man who's already got it. He says he's not ashamed of it. He knows exactly what he has. I know whom I have believed. Very well, then. The Christian is not a man who's seeking for it. He's not a man for hope who's hoping for it. He's a man who's actually got it. Now then, my friends, let's be clear about this. Owing to this terrible confusion at the present time, let me suggest to you a very simple test, which every one of you can apply to himself or herself tonight to know for certain whether you're a Christian or not. Here it is. Let's imagine that after you've gone home from this service, and those of you who are at home, you're sitting in your house, and suddenly someone comes knocking loudly at your door. You go to the door, and there you find a messenger. And you say, what's the matter? Well, he tells you that he's been sent there by a man whom you've known for years. He's a man whom you've perhaps been brought up with, and you've known him all your life. He's not a Christian. You were a Christian, but he's not. You've often met him, and when you've met him, you've talked to him about these things. You've seen the kind of life he's been living, wasting his money on drink and things of that description, neglecting his soul and his eternal destiny. And yet there was always something about him that rather attracted you. He was a nice fellow, and you felt sorry for him, and you kept contact with him. Well, here's the message. While we were in this service, this poor fellow's been taken desperately ill. He's had a sudden heart attack. They've sent for the doctor. The doctor's done his best, but suggests that they'd better call in a higher authority. And they've done so. And he says, take him to hospital at once. And there they're giving him this expert treatment, this emergency treatment. The man's desperately ill. And the doctors are quite agreed that there's very little chance of his living to reach midnight tonight. And the man suddenly awakens to this realization. He can see the anxiety on the face of his wife and his children. He can see the expression on the face of the doctors. He suddenly realizes that he's dying. And like the prodigal of old, having come to himself, he realizes he's in a desperate position. He can't lean on his past life. He knows now that it's all wrong. He comes to see the folly of it all. And yet he doesn't know anything. He can't face the future. He looks to the future. He sees nothing but blackness and darkness and despair. He's got no hope. He doesn't know what to do nor where to turn. And suddenly he thinks of you. And he thinks of you, of course, because he's known you as a Christian and a member of the church. So in his desperation, he sends for you. And this is the message. Well, what do you do? Well, you've no choice. You've got to go. And you arrive at the house, and you walk up the stairs, or you enter the bedroom, or there's the hospital, and here you are, and you're facing this poor fellow who's probably going to be dead before midnight tonight, and who's looking into your face and into your eyes as only a dying man can do, a man who's dying and who doesn't know how to die and who's afraid to die. Would you like to know whether you're a Christian or not? Here's the test. Have you got something that you can pass on to that man that'll make all the difference in the world to him? Now, will it help him if you turn to him and say something like this? Ah, well, my friend, at last you've awakened to the importance of the things about which I often spoke to you. At last you can see the foolish way in which you lived and have squandered your life and your capacities. At last you see the futility of it all. If only you'd lived the good life that I've lived, if only you hadn't done the things you've done, you wouldn't be feeling as you are now. Does that help the men? Of course it doesn't. That's to cast the man into hell before he's dead even. In other words, the Christian is not merely a good man. He's not merely a moral man. The Christian is a good man. But you see, he's not only that for this reason, that however moral you and I may be, you can't give your morality to another. You can't pass on, you can't use the apostle's word, you can't impart your morality to another. And yet, says Paul, by definition, the Christian is a man who's got something that he can give. He's a debtor. So he's not merely a moral man. Or I wonder whether it'll help the poor fellow if you turn to him and say something like this. Well, my dear friend, you're obviously dying and you know it, and you're now looking for salvation, for some hope. You know, I'm also looking. I've been seeking this for years. I've been reading books. I've been listening to the lectures of the great philosophers on the television. I'm a seeker and searcher after truth. I'm also looking after truth with you. Is that going to help the man who'll be dead before midnight tonight? No, no. It's to cast him into utter hopelessness and despair. I say again, the Christian is not merely a good man. He's not merely a man who's looking for truth and for salvation and for help. He's a man who says, I know, I have it, I can give it to you. He's a debtor. He has something in his possession that he can give to another. But wait a minute. The apostle adds to that definition. He amplifies it. You notice how he puts it. He says, I am debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. Now, this is a very important addition. What's it mean? Well, let me put it like this to you. I've met a few men who could say with honesty that they are debtors to the Greeks. What does that mean? Well, you know what sort of people the Greeks were. They were the great intellectualists of these early centuries. They were famous for their philosophy. The great philosophers were Greeks. And it was the Mecca, the place to which all people interested in philosophy went. And they were always arguing about truth and this theory and that theory, exactly as the same sort of people are doing today. Now, I say that I've met a few men who could say quite honestly that they're debtors to Greeks. If you gave them a congregation of philosophers, they'd be perfectly happy. They could put up this theory and then the other and compare them and contrast them and criticize them, and they could go on talking for hours. Debtors to the Greeks. But if you suddenly confronted them with a congregation of people who had never opened a textbook on philosophy and who knew nothing at all about it, perhaps not even the meaning of the word, they'd have nothing to say. And not only would they have nothing to say, they'd feel that you were insulting them by asking them to address such an ignorant crowd of men and women. They're debtors to the Greeks. They've got nothing to give to the barbarians. What of them? They're not Christians, says Paul. For the Christian is a debtor not only to the Greek, but also to the barbarian. Now, this is an important point, isn't it? These men, you see, who give this great show of learning and the impression that they understand the mysteries, they can only talk to one another, and they have nothing to give to the average men and women. That's not Christianity. But for me to be perfectly fair, I have known a few men who could say that they were debtors to the barbarians. I mean by that, that if you want a man who could play on the surface emotions of an ignorant crowd of people, well, they were masters at it. Hitler could do that, you know, and there are many people who are masters at handling a mob psychology, and they can play on people's emotions and make them do almost anything they like. Debtors to the barbarians. But if there happened to be a Greek kind of person there who came at the end and asked certain questions, they'd have no answer to give him. Debtors to the Greeks, nothing to give to the barbarians. What of them? Well, again, the apostle suggests that these are not Christians either. Or to be charitable, if they are Christians, they're very poor Christians. For the Christian, my friends, is not merely a man who's had an experience. He can tell you why he's had it. He can give you an explanation of it. You remember how Peter supports what this apostle says? Be ready, he says, to the ordinary Christian. Be ready at all times to give a reason for the hope that is in you. This is to me a most important matter. We are fighting not only false Christian teaching, we are fighting the cults at the present time. And the cults, you know, can give people experiences. That's why they succeed. Nobody'd belong to a cult if it didn't help them in some shape or form. The cults can give people experiences. They say their lives have changed. They've had some wonderful thrill, some wonderful mystical experience. How do we tell the difference between that and Christianity? This is the answer. That the Christian can give a reason for the hope that is in him. He's not only a debtor to the barbarian, he is also a debtor to the Greek. He's not merely a man who's had his life changed. He is a man who knows the truth as it is in Christ Jesus, the truth that this great apostle expounds in this great epistle to the Romans. Very well. This is what the apostle is saying. He says, I'm longing to be with you in Rome, and I'm ready to preach. I don't care who listens, he says. I'm ready to preach to the emperor. I've got a sermon for him. But I'm equally ready to preach to the slaves, to the servants, to the soldiers. Give me a man, says Paul. Give me a soul. I've got something to give him. I don't care whether he's a Greek or a barbarian. I don't care whether he's wise or unwise. I don't care whether he's wealthy, whether he's poor. I don't care what his psychology is. I don't care what his color is. I don't care what his nationality is. Give me a man, and I've got something to give him. Yes, he's got something to give, and he can give this something to anybody, to everybody. But lastly, he's a man who feels that he's bound to give it. He's got to give it. You see, Paul chose this word debtor quite deliberately. In order to bring out this idea of compulsion, he was very fond of saying this. And when we use this word debtor, we think of a man in a court and certain pressures being put to bear upon him in order to get from him this thing. Debtor. Now, Paul puts this in different ways. In writing in the first epistle to the Corinthians, he says, you ask me why I preach and why I travel as I do and why I'm so indefatigable. The answer, he says, is this. Woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. I can't help myself. I must do it. Indeed, he goes further in the second epistle to the Corinthians, and he puts it in this amazing phrase, the love of Christ constraineth me. What a term. He says, I'm like a man in a vice, and it's being tightened up. It's becoming tighter and tighter. The pressure of the love of Christ is driving it through me and out of me. I can't help myself. The love of Christ constraineth me. Now that's the idea that's in this word debtor. And this man feels, the Christian feels, that he's got to give this thing. Why does he feel this? Well, I could keep you at great length in answering the question. I mustn't do so. Let me summarize it for you. The Christian feels this, of course, because of what this gospel has done for him. It's made him a happy man, you see. And when a man is made a happy man and given some of the joy of the Lord, he feels that he wants everybody to rejoice with him. You know the type of man who's always sitting in the corner on his own? What's the matter with him? Well, he's a miserable man. He's got a problem. He's got a difficulty. And he spends his time talking to himself and arguing with himself. But the moment a man becomes full of joy, well, it's a kind of radiator. It's this word power. It's like a radiator. The man who's happy wants everybody to be happy with him. He's unhappy in a sense if everybody else isn't happy. There is something radiating, dynamic about this great joy which the gospel gives. And the apostle had received this. And every true Christian has received the same thing. And he wants everybody to share it with him. Now I want to put this to you in the form of an illustration. There's nothing original about it. Take this 16th verse. I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to every one that believeth. Now I'm going to tell you about that word power. In the early part of this very century in which we're living, a man burrowing in some ancient scrap heaps in Egypt found a little bit of parchment, what they call a papyrus, a document. And he made this interesting discovery. I'm only reporting it to you. It isn't my discovery. He discovered this, that the word which is translated power here in our King James Version, that same word was used in the first century for our word prescription. What a doctor gives you, prescription. So you can translate Romans 1:16, if you like this. I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, For it is the prescription of God unto salvation and to health and healing to every one that believeth. So you see, what the apostle is saying, I can put like this to you. What's a Christian? Why does he feel he's got to give this thing which he has to another? Look at it like this. Imagine a man who'd been suffering for years from some very painful and crippling disease. Some form of arthritis, if you like. There he was, poor fellow. His joints were not only painful, but he could scarcely move them at all. Of course, he'd gone to his doctor. The doctor had done his best, but the man was no better. He'd gone to a higher doctor, still no better. He'd gone to the highest doctor in the country, still no better. And here he was, beginning to settle down to a final hopelessness of pain and crippledom. When suddenly, he was told of some wonderful physician in some other continent. And he was so impressed by what he was told that he determined to go and see this great physician. And he went. And at last he finds himself in the room with this great man. And this physician looked at him and said, "Yes, I know exactly what's the matter with you, and I can cure you." And he sat down at his desk, and he put on his glasses, and he pulled out his pen, and he wrote a prescription. And he said to this man, "Well, now, you go and get that dispensed, and you take that medicine. And I can promise you, you'll begin to lose your pain, and then your joints will begin to get loose and supple again, and in a short while you'll feel as if you'd never been ill in your life." And the man did this. He took the prescription, took it to the chemist, the druggist, got his medicine, took it regularly, religiously, and as the great physician had prophesied, he lost his pain, he ceased to be a cripple, and he was perfectly well. Now this is his experience. He walks up the street, up and down the streets of life, and one afternoon he's walking down the street, and he suddenly sees a man on the other side of the street. He doesn't know the man, but he recognizes the disease. He can tell by the way that poor fellow's holding himself and the way he's shuffling along that he is suffering from his old disease, his old complaint. And he says to himself, "It's obvious that that man has never heard of the prescription that I've got in my pocket. What does he do about it? There's no need to argue. There's no need to have any counseling. There's no need to have any discussion. He says there's only one thing to do. I must cross the road. I must speak to that man." And he does so. He goes to him and says, "Excuse me, sir. You don't know me and I don't know you, but I do know what's the matter with you. Tell me, have you ever heard of this? The prescription. He's got a certain cure in his pocket, and that poor man needs it. He's suffering. He doesn't know about the cure. What does he feel? He says, I'd be a cad if I didn't tell him. It doesn't matter that I've not been introduced to him. It doesn't matter that I don't know him. I know his disease. I can sympathize. And I know of an absolutely certain cure. So he gives it. And that's the Christian. That's this man who's a debtor. He's got this something to give. He can give it to anybody. He feels he must give it. Why? Well, because it's the only cure. Because it is a certain cure. It's because of what Jesus Christ has done to him and for him. What has he done? He's given him forgiveness of sins, pardon, blotted them out as a thick cloud. He's reconciled him to God. He's made him a son of God. He's given him this heirship of eternity. He's given him new life and vigor and power, conquest over all temptations, which invariably got him down. He's made a new man of him, a healthy man, a whole man, a man who has salvation. And he opens out before him the glory of everlasting and eternal bliss. That's why he feels he's got to give it. Let us pray. O Lord, our God, we thank thee for so great a salvation. We feel that all our expressions are inadequate. We feel like saying with Charles Wesley of old, "Oh, for a thousand tongues to sing my great Redeemer's praise, the triumphs of my God and King, the wonders and the glories of his grace. Oh, God, tune our hearts to sing thy praise aright. Open all our eyes more and more by thy blessed Spirit, that we may see this salvation as it is in all its wonder and greatness and glory, and be lost in a sense of wonder, love, and praise. Amen.